Hi, Sam.
Hello, Chris. Hi.
Hi. Samuel, can I stop?
Yes, thank you. Are you? Well,
yeah,
I'm nervous.
Yeah. Are you nervous? Are you nervous?
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You might.
Yeah, I'm 88 and my memory's not what it was.
Yeah, I know. Well, don't worry too much because we'll prompt you as we go along. Pieces got plenty
you.
Of
okay.
questions to
thank
ask you.
You.
And usually with these things, after 5 or so minutes, people start to relax a little bit. So don't worry if you're a bit nervous to begin with. That's quite understandable.
Okay,
and
thank
very,
you.
Very
no, thank
normal.
You.
So Samuel, can you start by telling me your full name, your date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Yes, it's Samuel Andrew Deeth. Mm-hmm. And the spelling, would you like me to spell it for you?
Deeth. Yeah, that's great.
You probably got it correct anyway. It's D. apostrophe, a capital E, small a, T-H-E, Deeth.
Wow.
It rhymes with teeth.
Teeth. where does that name come from? Where's the origin? Where does it originate?
Well, I don't know. I've been trying to trace it, but nobody to ask, really. But it could come from a place called Dath in Belgium, D apostrophe A-T-H, I'm told.
Right.
Or the name occurred in Belgium in the 18th century, apparently, when there was a persecution of the Huguenots, the Protestant Huguenots, and they fled from Belgium and settled in parts of the UK,
right.
The southeast particularly, and the name does occur there. Now, whether that's so, but also I've also heard that it's another name for a picker up of faggots. I prefer the Belgian version, and also the character in the medieval plays of death, because I know it was spelled D-E-A-T-H, death, and
right.
over the years they've stuck an E on the end, put an apostrophe in and put a capital E, so it doesn't look too much like death,
like
I think
death,
that's,
yeah.
But it was deep when I was at the Blue Coat. The spelling that you've got now, was it the Blue Coat? Because I've got my, birth certificates and that. So
That's fascinating. I've never heard that surname before. Date of birth, Samuel. And,
oh, sorry.
Yeah, and where
21st of November,
right.
1931.
Wow, and you were born in Liverpool.
I was born in. Do you want my address? I was born in Edge Hill, Liverpool.
Okay.
By Myrtle Street, 6 Stanley Place. It was actually
right. Wow.
Liverpool 7, but it's no longer the house is no longer there.
No, they've all been
knocked
down.
Went back years
down.
Ago, and it's all gone. Yeah.
Great. Can you tell me a little bit about your early life, Samuel? A bit about your mum, your dad, your siblings, what your dad
well,
did?
Well, my mum, it was... Are you there? I'm sorry, the line seems to be...
Yeah, we're still here,
Well, my father, he was in the First World War, I think, because he was about 25 or 26 when the First World War...
Yeah.
You know, this happened. He was ineligible to be called up. But I know nothing about that side of it. My sister's daughter got in touch with me a few years ago and said that she was my sister's daughter. And I asked about my father. And my sister, said that one day she would tell me, he died of his war wounds. But I know nothing about that.
Wow.
He died, according to the certificate, from myocarditis and chronic bronchitis. I never knew him to work. He was always at home, always ill, had a very bad chest.
Mm.
And he died when he was 53 in January 1941.
Mm.
And then my mother died from gastric perforations and post-operative of pneumonia, age 44, in July 1941.
Oh,
and
dear.
It was just a little mix-up. I didn't know where I was, really. But I had 2 sisters, but they were 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
And one of them had married, and I didn't know she was my sister. not until much later on, came to light that she was my sister, because she was never at home. She always used to call down the gate, or she was just a family friend. But anyway, that was it, really. I just...
So you lost both your parents when you were only 10?
I lost
10?
Both parents. I was only nine, and I lost them. I was nine, and then I went to live with my sister, who I didn't know was my sister. I went to live with her and her husband, and I had a horrendous time.
He beat you, it was just
violence. He used to hit the sister, hit me. I ran away and spent the night in an air raid shelter in Liverpool just by myself. And I thought, what the heck, what am I going to do now? Anyway, I went back to, it wasn't far from where I lived, where I played. I went back and played with my friends in the street. And my sister came for me and took me back home. And he had a whole pile of jam putties, as we call them, jam and bread. And he had them on the plate. And he says, when you've eaten that, I'm going to belt you, you know. And he had a strap on the end of the back of the chair. And of course, as soon as I'd eaten, at least he fed me first. So I have to be thankful for that. And then he belted living daylights out of me. And then he just got me in. And then he moved where he lived, Angela Street it was, in Liverpool. And then he moved to Tubrook. But he was horrible. And my niece bears that out. She said he was a horrible dad. And my sister was very gentle sort. And I know he beat her. And anyway, he got me into the Blue Coats. And I only saw my sister once whilst I was in the Blue Coats. An aunt, my father's sister, turned up out of the blue and arranged for me to meet my sister. And she was gaunt and thin. You know, she was very thin and very ill, really. And I only saw her for about a quarter an hour, 20 minutes. And then I never saw her again. And...
This was the sister you'd been living with.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they moved from Angela Street in Liverpool. I've forgotten the district now. Isn't it Edgehill? Yeah, wasn't far away because I walked there when my father died. When my mother died, I had to go to my sister's, and I walked there. It's not that far.
Yeah.
And I could tell as soon as I entered the house by the look on his face that. I was very unwelcome.
Yeah.
So,
How come you never saw your sister again after that meeting? What happened to her?
They put me in the Blue Coat School, and I wiped the memory of it. I just didn't think about it. It's a terrible thing, doesn't it, really? But I didn't think. She never had me back. They never had me back home.
No.
I stayed in the Blue Coat. When the children went for holidays, there was a little caucus of us stayed behind, and I was one of those. And then I went to my aunt, my father's, my mother's sister. She took me for a while. And then one day there was a horrible mix-up. I was going for a holiday there, and nobody came to meet me at the station. And the teacher who was with me said, well, you know, do you know where you took her? I was about 12, I think, 13. I said, yes, I know the way. So I got the bus and arrived at my aunt's house. That's my father's sister's house. And she was out. And I always remember when she came round the corner and I was sitting on the step in my suitcase. The look on her face told it all, you know, that I wasn't... I wasn't, you know, I shouldn't have been there. Yeah. And she said, your sister Rose should have had... You should have gone to your sister Rose's. She's got to take her share. They were trying to farm me out between, the sister Rose and her. But they never got in touch with me, and the headmaster did. You know, he didn't go into it at all. You know, he just arranged. He must have thought that I was still going to my aunt's in Wobbersee.
Yeah.
But so I stayed there for a while. And then I went to a friend's in Birkenhead, stayed with a friend's family there. But I just sort of rejected my family. Sounds terrible, I know, but it was the way it was, you know, in those days. I didn't want to go back to my
No.
Or the sister, but I wasn't given the option, you know. No, never said, there was no talk about it. The head, Mr. Walker, never mentioned going back to my sister.
Yeah.
And I didn't ask, so that's briefly what it was, really. But
so had you been,
the situation.
Had you been close to your sister Rose before, she got...
Well, she used to come to the house when...
When your mother was alive.
My mum and dad were alive.
Yeah.
She used to come and visit. I didn't know she was my sister. Sounds awful, doesn't it? But I didn't know she was my sister. She'd married somebody. Apparently, it sounds awful, but apparently she married this chappie, and he used to beat her. And then there was this other chap living in the flat above, and he went down and rescued my sister from this violent man. And he took her home with him. So my sister and this chappie who took her off this away from a married man they couldn't marry. So I think she changed her name by deed poll.
Yeah.
And they lived together. But then he used to beat her as well. But the poor sister was just a punchbag, and she was a very kind soul. I'm very delicate. No, it was just a so I just shut it all out, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I just blotted it all out.
That's a way of coping with it. That's a coping strategy that a child creates to cope. Yeah.
So your older sister that you lived with for a while was called Rose, is that right? And the eldest sister of all that you didn't know was your sister. What was her name?
Violet. She was Violet. She disappeared off the scene completely.
Oh, I see.
Right. I don't know what happened to her.
Yeah.
She was quite friendly with my aunt, my father's sister, actually.
Yeah.
And but I don't know what happened to her. I spoke when my niece, her daughter, rang me up. She said that she thought that she went to Germany and lived in Germany. She had a child.
Right.
Well, yes, Violet came to one of the Shirley Hall services.
Oh.
Funny enough, on the Sunday that I was chosen to, we have to have them memorize psalms or texts from the Bible and say them in front of all the audience in the Shirley Hall.
Mm.
And I happened to be saying one that day when my sister arrived, and she was pregnant then with... it'd be my nephew, wouldn't it? And then I saw her when I left school after that for a short time, and then I just lost touch.
Yeah.
So she didn't get in touch with me at the Blue Coat till Mrs. Violet until about just about 16 or 17, and I can always remember the opening sentence of the letter: "Dear Sam, no doubt you'd be surprised to hear from me for such a long time."
Mm.
And but the headmaster had opened the letter. He always opened the mail and read it, and he said, "Well, yes, you should have got in touch with you before now, you know."
Yeah.
It's all right for getting in touch now that you're going to leave. And he was very, you know, cross about it all.
Yeah.
But so I did go in touch. I did get in touch, and, you know, for a while, but I had no interest now. The family had gone, as far as I was concerned.
Mm.
You know, I sort of blotted it out at school. The Blue Coat was heaven sent for me.
Oh, good.
I couldn't wait. When I first went there, and my sister said that I was going in the Blue Coat, and her partner said, "So you'll be there till you're 21. You know, and I nearly was, actually.
What was the circumstance of you getting into the school then? How did that come about?
I don't know. He just said, "You're going to the Blue Coat School."
Right.
I think what it was, I spoke to asked my niece about this, and she said that he, as far as she remembered, he wanted to go to the Blue Coat in London, I think.
Mm.
I think it was Christ Hospital.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And for some reason, he didn't go.
Yeah.
He couldn't get there. And she thought that embittered him.
Really?
But he was awful. You know, he was violent. And he just said I was going to the Blue. And I was too scared to ask him any questions or anything. I just accepted the fact I was going. And I thought to myself, oh, good.
Yeah.
And when I got there, I'm sorry, I'm going on, aren't I?
No, not at all. It's fine.
I got there with Rose, took me, my sister Rose, and she took me for the interview. And I remember going, we had the interview in Liverpool, Church Road, and we went, it must have been the billiard or the music room, and I could see these cues, billiard cues on the wall, and I thought they were canes. I thought, oh, heck, you know, I'm not going to get cane. But anyway, because Dr. Dickinson was one of the, he interviewed me. I think there was a medical doctor there, actually, because I was supposed to have the tonsils out. I don't remember anybody else, and I had to read A Passage from the Water Babies, a Charles Kingsley member. And I was happy with that because I was okay with reading, you know. And then they asked me a little few questions about mental arithmetic. How many pence were in half a crown? I remember. I knew that was 30. I got down a couple of others. That seemed to be all right, I think. Maths was never my strong point. The fingers were working overtime behind my back. But I seemed to be okay. And anyway, the next thing was that I'd been accepted. So Rose took me home. I was almost triumphant when I said to him, well, I've got in, you know. And he just grunted. And that was it, really. And I remember, Dr. Dickinson came to the house twice.
Yeah.
He came once. He didn't come try them. And I was supposed to go to the Blue Coat. There was a date fixed. And for some reason, I don't know, I didn't go for the interview. Yeah. Then Dr. Dickinson came to the house another time and sorted it out with my sister. And so another date was arranged. And so I went then for the interview. And I remember my sister taking me to the train. I think it was Lime Street to Bangor, and put me on the train. And she gave me, funny enough, half a crown, pocket money. And I was on the train with a few other children, not many. And Dorothy Smith, it was, I think, who was with me, the one who was the lady who was the head of the girls, Mrs. Dorothy Smith. And she wrote a book called Those Graylin Girls, which I've got here, and it was a book based on the Blue Coat School, about these children in an orphanage, and it was very old-fashioned, and teachers were out of touch and everything, and gradually a new teacher came, and the school changed, and they gradually got, instead of sleeping in dormitories, they had their own little rooms and so on. Mm. It was a vision of the Blue Coats of the future, I think. She was on the train. I didn't know her then, of course. She just a quiet figure sitting in the corner, making the odd comment. I remember going in the train going out to the station. A lot of workmen are on the line, another line repairing the railway line. They waved and we waved back, and that was it. I remember going to Bangor, and then we got out at Bangor. There was a coach waiting for us, and we got on the boat, the coach. And it took us to Ragman Street, remember, in Beaumaris.
Yeah.
And there we met Mr. Watkin, he was acting head, he was deputy head, but he was acting head. And he introduced himself. I always remember, he said, "My name is Mr. Watkin, and I want you all to work hard." And then there was a senior prefect there, and he helped Mr. Watkin with us. You know, we got blue coat clothes. Well, we had a bath, that's right. They bathed us, fed us, and then we got changed into blue coat clothes. And I'll never, never, ever forget getting into new clothes at the school. How excited I felt. Oh. I never felt that. I was overwhelmed with excitement. I didn't say anything, of course, didn't show anything, but I was so excited about it. It sounds strange, doesn't it? But it was overwhelming, the feeling of having new clothes, I've been fed back, and I felt like $1 million.
Wow. I was just going to say, Samuel, it sounds like your first impressions were really positive.
Oh, they were. Mm. Absolutely. I know there were snags, there were ups and downs. I wasn't saying it was all beer and skittles. It wasn't, you know. But on the whole, I think the Blue Coats was, you know, saved me, really. Mm. I think it's no exaggeration to say. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't gone.
Wow.
But it certainly put me on the right path, you know, pointed. Yeah. It had its snags, of course, but then there were hard days, weren't there, with World War.
Absolutely.
And,
well, yes, I mean, was it
cash
quite...
The cash flow must have been, you know, dicey, and maybe had all these children, you know, under their care. It must have been hard, but we didn't think about that when we were children. I was just glad to be there, away from that. And I always, always regret that I never got in touch with this. Well, only for that brief moment. I just lost the family completely.
Well, I mean, it seems like, you know, they wholeheartedly rejected you. So you seem to be passed around like a package. So it's not surprising. Tell me briefly, was it quite a fearful time to be in Liverpool during the war? I mean, was that another good reason to get out?
It was, because I didn't... Pardon?
Was that another good reason to get out of Liverpool?
I didn't think of that, actually. We were there for the... I was there for the Blitz, all the Blitz. When I went in 1942, we'd had the May Blitz in Liverpool, and our house was very, very nearly hit, so around us, our houses were being bombed.
Mm.
We had an air raid shelter in the cellar. It was corrugated iron on the ceiling, held up by metal poles, which were encased in a concrete square. And when the sirens went, warning, we just went in the cellar. I don't think it would have... If we'd had a direct hit on the house, it wouldn't have stayed. But I suppose it was better than nothing, you know. And there was an air raid shelter in the street, actually, but nobody went into it, as far as I knew.
Mm.
So all the when I went to the Blue Coat, 1942, February, I think, it was end of January, February, most of the raids had finished. I think there were one or two sporadic raids later on. But I didn't think of it in terms of getting away from the bombing. I just accepted the bombing, you know, it just... because my mum and dad were alive anyway, most of it. So it was just that I was just glad to be away from the family, you know, from the sister and her partner.
Sounds like it was a safe haven for you going to.
Well, it was, and of course, it was safe for many air raids. Of course, there were. I think there were one or two air raids in 1942. I'm not sure. But there was never anything in Beaumaris, you know. Where I just, it was just like a new world. I just entered a new world. And it's a lovely country. It's a lovely part of the country. I wasn't used to, I was born in a back street. I wasn't used to mountains and the Menai Straits and the grass and the fields and the cows and the horses and all the country, you know, picking blackberries and so on. It was quite a new experience for me. I don't suppose I fully appreciated at the time, but I certainly do and do now. I did when I left, but you know, that was just the way it was, really.
Yeah.
So, what was the schooling like in Paris? Did you learn very much? Do you reckon?
It was when I went to Paris. So we were billeted. We called them our host and hostess, and I was with a baker who had a baker's shop, and we went to the local school, Bryn it was called, yes, Bryn.
That's right,
it was a converted house, and we had our schooling there, and I think it was, it must have been pretty basic, but it's all right, and we taught us Shakespeare and French, and one of the horrific moments is when Mr. Watkin... Is it all right if I speak like this? I'm sorry.
Absolutely. It's great. Well, you know, carry on,
Mr. Watkin mimicked me in front of the class. He asked me a question, and I answered it, and he mimicked me with a very strong Liverpool accent. I must have had a strong Liverpool accent.
Oh.
And I felt terrible, and for that, I'm sure from that moment I never spoke with a poor accent. We used to have speech lessons actually for Mrs. Smith in Bryn. She, you know, we carried the spare chair up the steep stair, you know, that sort of thing. But
yeah,
we're all Liverpool lads, so I wasn't aware I had an accent, except
no.
when I lived with my sister, there was one occasion when her partner, he called a tram car a car, I think.
Yeah.
And I imitated that just to please him.
Yeah.
You know how you try to please those you're frightened of.
That's right.
And whether I picked anything up there, I don't know. But but Mr. Watkin brought it home in no uncertain manner that I spoke with a Liverpool accent, which I dropped. And, that was there. But the rest of schooling, I liked Mrs. Smith because she taught us English literature. And I thought she was very good. And I always remember she started off with The Merchant of Venice, and the opening lines were, she'd tell us a story first in an exciting way, and then we started off with the opening lines, "In sooth, I know not why I'm so sad, it wearies me," you say, "it wearies you," I think that's something like that, "it wearies you," and she was saying, you know, she was discussing the fact that Antonio spoke these lines. He was worried about something that might be going to happen to his ships, you know.
Mm.
And he had a fear that something was going to happen. She said, "Now, what do you call it?" And she introduced the word, the presentiment. And I always remember a presentiment. She said something, a foreboding that something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Bad, you know, something bad's going to happen. And she'd introduce words like that, and propinquity, nearness. I remember using these words.
Mm.
And they fascinated me. And she's read poetry and so on, and I liked their lessons. But we used to have music lessons there, and I was reading an article the other day about from an ex-Brookhope girl, and she said she remembers Bryn, and she remembers the boys with boots on, clambering up the stairs, all this clatter of boots, and they only ever sang one of the song. One of the seafaring songs. I can't remember what it was now. And it's not true. We did sing a couple, but not many. We had "Where Have You Been All the Day, Billy Boy," and "On Friday Morn," when "Boney Was a Warrior." She said that's all she ever heard. "Boney Was a Warrior," but we sang a couple of other songs. And it was Mr. Borden, the music master. He was a Welshman. He used to come to the school and take us for music. But I enjoyed singing and everything. The only thing I didn't enjoy was art. I couldn't draw for toffee and maths as well. But Mr. Watkin put the fear of God into me in maths, so I can't blame him really, but, you know. Mr. Watkin and Matt and me were strangers. We were never properly introduced, I don't think. I never really understood. But anyway, that was...
So then when you moved back after the war, you came back to Wavertree site, and was that quite a... Were you shell-shocked when you came back to Liverpool?
No. When we came back, we had a long holiday, long summer holiday. I thought I was never going to go back.
Mm.
And anyway, when we got, because of course it had been used as part of the War Office, I think. The building. It was tracing missing persons, something like that. Something to do with the war.
That's right. It was part of the War Office, and you're quite right. It was the Department for Missing Persons.
They had to get it all ready for us. It must have been an absolute nightmare for the staff, Mr. Watkin. It must have been. We just went back, you know.
Very different atmosphere, though.
Pardon?
A very different atmosphere.
The atmosphere?
Yes, very different atmosphere in Wavertree compared to Beaumaris.
I always say that in Beaumaris, I played in Liverpool. I worked. Yes, it was a good atmosphere. But we had in Beaumaris, especially when I was billeted with the baker's shop. We used to deliver the bread down to people and to Buckley Arms and all that. Two of us, and we got six sixpence a week for that. But we had the freedom in Beaumaris. we could go out and play in the street. We played hopscotch, and there were swings nearby. We could go on the swings. Mm. It was just like living in a normal home.
Yeah.
And I had a home hostess. The only downside was that I had to go to the dentist once, and I had a tooth out, and it was bleeding like fury. And at night, I couldn't do my homework. Now, I was one of these little swats, I think, who didn't mind doing homework. Yeah. And I tried it, and the blood went all over my book. And I remember the hostess saying, Mrs. Davis, saying, "Oh, don't do that now. Go to bed, sort of thing. Don't worry about your homework." So I didn't. Mm. But the next day, I was sent for, and it wasn't Mr. Watkin. Then Mr. Heritage was the headmaster. He was headmaster for a couple of years, Mr. Heritage.
Mm.
He came, was headmaster, and then he left. And he sent for me, and he wanted to know why. And I told him, and he just got his belt and just, you know, gave me six strokes on the bottom.
Oh.
And I thought that was unjust, because, and I thought the hostess should have really written the notes or something, but I don't know. It was just, I felt that was very unjust.
Yeah, yeah.
But, we actually asked to leave Mr. and Mrs. Davis, a few of us there, because one of the prefects used to come and slipper us at night in our pyjamas. We were in our pyjamas, they'd come with the slipper and, you know, use it on us at night, talking in bed or for making a bit of a noise and that. So in the end, we got fed up with it and asked to go to Woodgarth, the hostel there, and we went there. But to go to Liverpool, I found it okay. I was older, of course, knew a bit more.
Yeah.
But I found it, there was less freedom there. I remember my friend and I went for a walk once. And we just went out for a walk in the evening.
Mm.
And he was a clever chap, and he was talking about Aristotle and Plato. It was a very one-sided conversation, but he was, And then we came back, and the duty master had happened to call the roll, had a roll call, and we were missing. And of course, Mr. Watkin went up in the air, you know.
Mm.
He really got cross with us, and we were prefects, and he demoted us. We got demoted to sub-prefect. We got our prefectship back eventually, but he wasn't very happy. And I can understand why. Two boys missing. Could have been anywhere, you know.
Mm.
It was a silly thing for us to do. But we that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, in Bemoris. That could only happen. They were all together in the school. They kept tabs on us, much closer tabs on us than they did in Bemoris.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I found the school.
What? Carry on.
I just found the school okay, you know. I just did my lessons, and I should have left without anything, really, because I stayed till I was 18. And then I went straight into the army to do my national service, 2 years national service.
Mm.
But while I was there, they took the school certificate. I took my school certificate when I was there with two boys and a girl. The girl dropped out, but the two boys and I stayed on. And we took our school certificate there in 1949. But I was 18 then, so I was well overdue. But I just, you know, the head never spoke to me about going to the sisters or anything. It was just assumed that I wouldn't be going, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
do you remember, Samuel, your friend Seaton Smith or Seaton Unwin?
Peter Unwin. Oh, yes. He rang me.
Yes.
He telephoned me.
His name's Seaton. Seaton, S-E-T.
Seaton, that's right.
Yeah.
Seaton. He remembered me. I didn't remember him.
Mm.
And we had some conversations, on the telephone. And we actually met up in Liverpool.
Okay.
With his wife and mine. And we had a drink and that. And a little chat about school. I've lost touch with him, actually.
Well, actually, that's the surprise for you. We've actually just had an interview with Seaton about half an hour ago. And
oh, right.
Yeah, and he mentioned you very fondly. So, yeah, remind us at the end, and we could pass on presumably his phone number to you, because he seems keen to want to catch up with you as well. So, at the
end, that would be great. Yeah, have his number.
Yeah,
we just lost touch, you know. You do. Yeah, he was living in down south somewhere, wasn't
that's
he?
That's right. He's in Poole in Dorset.
Dorset, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. We'll give you his number at the end. It'd be nice for you to.
That would be nice. Have a chat. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, were there subjects that you excelled at school, or were you good at sport? What was the things you enjoyed?
Well, I was quite good at sport. I enjoyed the sport. I captained the cricket team.
Yeah.
But I was older, you see. I think that's a bit of a cheat. But I enjoyed cricket right from the moment I entered the school, really, when they played cricket on the green in Bemorris. Yeah. I was watching the older boys. And I thought I could do as good as that.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. But, I enjoyed sport. I enjoyed running.
Yeah.
I enjoyed studying as well. I wasn't a brilliant scholar by any means. But I was okay. You know, I was average. I enjoyed my lessons. And I didn't like maths because of Mr. Hawkin taking some maths. It must have been something in me. Because he used to go so fast. And sometimes I would be sitting, he'd have his back to me, and I couldn't see the board very well. I only tried to make excuses, I suppose. But when I took the school certificate, I took the Oxford school certificate, and I didn't have to take maths, but I had to take a science, which I did all right. I liked science. That was okay. And so I got the school certificate. That otherwise I would have had to. I don't think you could do that now. I think maths is compulsory, which I think it should be anyway.
Yeah.
But I always felt I missed out in maths, really, because the other two boys who took the school certificate with me, they both did maths and did very well. One got this, not at all, they both didn't get distinctions, certainly one did. But he used to take them to his room, the boys, and coach them in his room, and I was left out. I always remember sitting once with a group of boys, and he was taking some older boys for maths, and we were in the same room, same classroom, and there was Mr. Watkin teaching these boys about geometry and you know, the size of a triangle and A plus B equals C plus B, and I was trying to read the poem called "The Deserted Village." And there was me with "Sweet was the sound when up at evening's close, beyond the hill the village murmur rose." And I was trying to read this, and this maths lesson was going on the other side. And it was a chaotic situation, really. But I don't know why that was so. I don't know. It was just, I don't think Mr. Watkin ever intended me to have maths. He did say to me when I was leaving, I could always take maths at night school, but I never did.
No. Any other memories that you have, or any other funny anecdotes, or anything you can think of?
I think I remember once we were playing in Bemorris, and we got one boy would climb on another boy's shoulders, and we would go knocking on the door, and we went to. One boy, it sounds so silly this, but one boy got on my shoulders, I think, or I got on, no, he got on mine, I think, and we went to the house where we lived in my Suffred, and I knocked on the door, intended to go boo, you know, and Mr. Watkin opened the door, and then he died. he'd come to visit. The host and hostess see how we're behaving. I think he got a bad impression, and we went through, and I nearly died when I saw him because I was absolutely in awe of him.
What way were you in awe of him then? Was it was it a fear thing, or were you quite inspired by him?
Because he used to cane you.
Okay.
He caned us. I wasn't caned that much, but I was caned by him, and I can't remember what it was for. Couldn't be that much, but I was caned by him. And he used to stand, so he used to go in this little ante room and put us in a sort of like a semicircle, and he'd go around each one of us, and it was quite traumatic. That it was,
yeah.
He wouldn't give you more than 6 strokes of the cane, but I don't think I got 3 or something. But it was very, very, you know, hurtful. You can imagine. We used to go back to the class, and you couldn't hold your pen. Man, the teachers were very good. They didn't say anything. You know, I just sat there because I couldn't hold a pen.
Mm.
And also, he'd slap you over the face now and again for various misdemeanors.
Mm.
And he slapped me once over the face for something to do with a mix-up over a school blazer. And I didn't understand this at all, as I hadn't taken anybody's blazer. Anyway, he found out that it was the other boy's fault, wasn't mine. So he said to me, "Well, I have punished you now," he said. "So that punishment will stand. The next time you do something wrong, I won't punish you."
Mm.
And I thought, no, that won't happen, and it didn't. You know, he forgot that. But he was a dynamic sort of character, a strange sort of man, I thought, in some ways. He was a very clever man, very energetic. He ran that school, you know, really like a martinet.
Mm.
And we just were in awe of him. It was just his personality, really.
Mm.
And also the fact that he could, you know, he could use the cane.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say things like, he would say things in front of other children, which I didn't always like, because I was playing in football on the field, I'm just kicking the ball around on a warm day. And he came and he saw me with my shirt off, but he called me an oaf and things. He's, you know, he really told me off. So, But on the other hand, he could be kind. He gave me a very good reference. He wrote to me whilst in the forces. You know, a strange mixture, really. I think it was just the times. I think the cane was very widely used in schools.
It was.
Wasn't it? I remember going... I became a primary school teacher eventually, and I remember going on my first teaching practice, and this class teacher had the cane hung up on the blackboard and used it on 10-year-olds, you know, and I thought, this is not right, you know, for talking in class, you know. So, anyway, so I suppose it was just part of the times, you know. Physical punishment was very much, you know, the way of controlling children.
It was.
In some cases, yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. How do you feel you did academically then at the Blue Coat?
Well, I got my school certificate.
Mm.
So I did all right, because there were quite a few staff changes. I mean, I was taking geography, and there was no geography teacher, you know. I took scripture, and there was no scripture teacher. But they kept changing them. And then, in the end, a lady came, and I was the only one doing scripture.